Pledge allegiance to the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
See, Ken Kaler will not be here. He's on vacation still, so he will not be here tonight for roll call. And citizen input is next. If we have any citizens that would like to address the council on an item that is council business but not on tonight's agenda, please raise your hand. I'll acknowledge you, and you can come to the mic and give us your name and address, and we'll give you up to 5 minutes. Okay, since there's no input there, approval of agenda. Do I hear a motion? Gina, first it. Have a second?
Second.
Second, okay. Discussion. No, you can bring it up.
I would like to make a friendly change to that. As I would like to remove item 3.3 from the consent agenda and move that to the bottom of our regular agenda, make that a separate discussion item. I have some information to share with the council on that one.
Okay. Okay, that'll become 4.6. We'll put approval of accounts payable checks for the 2011. So we'll move that out of there, 3.3 down to 4.6 in current business. Any other discussion? Okay, so I hear a motion for the approval of the agenda without 3.3 in there. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same? Okay, that passes. Okay, consent agenda. Do I hear a motion for that? Okay.
Second.
And that's minus 3.3. Sorry about that. Okay, any more discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same? Okay, that passes. Okay, employee recognition. Officer Homer Montemayor, you want to come up?
It's fun. One of the things about being mayor is when you get these on these people who are giving the recognitions to, I think, how did you get on this tent? Yeah, you're 39, is that what you said? 29. Officer Montemayor started in the police department in January 1st, 1991, as a patrolman, married his wife, Velma, back here. He's a father of 7 children.
Congratulations, I love kids.
You know, and 4 grandchildren, I think he got 5. So, and he was born and raised in Othello. Started patrol and has served in the following assignments: K-9 officer, 8 years, dogs Lex and Harley, tactical response team, investigations, detective 2 years, school resource officer, DARE 5 years, grade 2 years, explorers program advisor for 6 years, unarmed defensive tactics master, OC spray instructor, and currently assigned as a school resource officer for the past 2 years. So this is an appreciation, dedication, and support for 20 years to the citizens of Othello, Homer Montemayor, 1991 to 2011. Congratulations.
Okay, 4.2, biased 2011 service agreement. Mike?
Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Mayor and Council. Annually, BIAS Software submits their software maintenance and service agreement to us. And this one is for 2011, and it's a standard agreement for this type of service. From the time of our initial installation up to the present, we found BIAS personnel to be very responsive to our request and enjoy working with them. The total budgeted in 2011 is $7,700. And 4 cents. I should have that here. Staff recommends approval of this agreement, and the motion to approve it is to move to approve the BIAS 2000, That should not be 2010. That should be 2011 software service agreement.
Questions? Okay, so do I hear a motion to move to approve BIOS 2011 software service agreement?
Make that motion.
Mark Snyder first.
Second.
Second, Dan. Any more further discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same. Okay, thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Okay, well, number six update. Potential funding request, Kevin Lindsay and Larry.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Council. As you may recall, over the past few months, we've been working on the rehabilitation of well number six, which is the well that's quite high in fluoride. Fluoride has been regulated by the EPA and Ecology. And if you have a well that produces over 4 milligrams per liter, or parts per million, that's the trigger to do something about it. There's various aquifers in well six that are producing over 15 milligrams per liter. So the city received a grant from the Community Development Block Grant Recovery Program, ARRA monies, to investigate and determine and fix the problem with fluorides. One of the issues involved was a liner or sleeve in the bottom 200 feet of this approximately 1,200 foot deep well hole that Department of Ecology was adamant that we try to remove. Well, we felt sure that it would never come out because it's been in the ground for some time, and you start trying to wiggle and pull on this metal tube that's been in the ground for that long, and typically what happens is it collapses on you. Well, the contractor very carefully started to wiggle it, and it came right out. It just flabbergasted everybody. In doing so, the bottom 200 feet of that about 1,200 foot deep well hole, it's about 18 inches in diameter, was exposed to the rest of the well. And the water bearing zones that are that deep had been cut off before. What we found out was that we believe the highest fluoride producing zones were actually in that bottom 200 feet rather than around 900 feet, which we have thought from investigations along with GSI Kevin Lindsay of a few years ago. When the well screen came out, a bunch of the loose gravels and rocks that were held back actually fell into the hole. So the well now is about 1,000 feet deep rather than 1,200. So we've partially collapsed off that high producing zone, but we feel we're still getting some very high fluorides from that area. And that leads us to a couple of different options as far as what to do with the fluorides in that bottom around the 1,000 foot zone. And Kevin is here to discuss a couple of options and recommendations, and then we can also talk about cost ramifications. So I'll turn it over to Kevin.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Paul. Some of you remember this. My low-tech poster on what does well six look like? So what do we think is going on now? That diagram gives us some of the basic numbers that I'll be talking about. I want to review quickly, because I know several of you are new, I want to review quickly where we were and how we got to where we are, so we're taking a moment or two. But it's important for this discussion, I'm trying to figure out what next. That is the original configuration of well six prior to all the work that was done on it. Basically, it was cased and sealed of approximately 211 feet. It was an open basalt hole to the bottom at 1,210 feet originally. As Larry said, the bottom 200 feet, that's the black thick markings on the bottom. From basically 997 to 1,210 was a sequence of a steel liner and steel screen with two open intervals in that steel screen at 1017 to 1037 and 1077 to 1057 to 1077. Those two intervals are also producing water into the well. There are a number of water producing intervals in that well. They're all highlighted on that poster in red. all those different depth ranges of where we thought based on a variety of stuff were from the original Driller's Law to some work WSU had done in the 70s to the work we did over the past couple of years. All that red tells you where we think water was getting into the well. Static water level in that well has been over the past couple of years anywhere just above and below approximately 400 feet below ground surface. When we did a video a couple weeks ago, it was a 393. When we did a bunch of the investigative work 2 years ago, it was a 412. So it's bouncing around 400 feet approximately. And again, the red is where we think water is getting into the hole. From what you, for those of you who heard a couple years ago, we ran a test system into this well when the pump was in place to try to figure out where fluoride was coming from in the well because of experience with well 8. Well 8 was your most recently drilled well. It was drilled in the early 2000s. It produced pretty good water until it hit a depth of approximately 950 to 960, at which point it had both hole control stability problems, a lot of rubbly rock collapsing. With that rubbly rock collapse was the big fluoride hit on well 8. Between the big fluoride hit on well 8 and the rubble collapse, that led to the bottom 40 feet of that hole being plugged with cement and then it just being completed basically as a well to 930 or 40. I'd have to go back and look that up. But the bottom 30 or 40 feet of that well was plugged off because rubble and high fluoride. That got us thinking about this well and the basic wisdom, where is the fluoride coming from? Is it really coming from the bottom? Or is it coming from that 900 to 1,000 foot depth range? So in 2007, 2008, we ran a couple of test systems in the hole while it was producing water at 2,400 gallons a minute to see if we could profile where the fluoride was coming in. At that time, we thought the fluoride was coming in at approximately 910 feet. The big fluoride hit was at 910. Specifically, the fluoride profile in that well while it was pumping 2,400 gallons a minute looked essentially like the two screen intervals at 1017 and at 1037 were producing fluoride concentrations in excess of 5 milligrams per liter. We thought we had a big fluoride hit at 910, which kicked it up to 15. Above that, then, we thought we had fluoride decreasing to below 4, so that on all that water, the 5 milligram plus water at the bottom, there's a parent 15 milligram hit at 920, and then the water above that, when that water is all mixed together in the well bore, that well generally produces water, all this water mixed together, of approximately 4.7 to 4.8 milligrams per liter. So our target, in talking to you all a couple years ago, was to try to knock out the highest fluoride and then try to preserve as much production capacity in this well as possible. And that challenge is there because probably in half of the production in this well is from that bottom interval, that 5 milligram per liter interval. We think the 15 milligram, or we thought the 15 milligram spike at 910, 920, was kicking in some water, but not a lot. And then the balance of that production was probably coming in above that in the upper part of the hole, 1,000 to 1,500 gallons a minute. Again, we tested at 24. We know this well can ramp up to 3,000. We weren't able to test it at 3,000 at the time because of how we had to, we could not dispose of the water to the city system. We just disposed it straight to waste and disposed straight to waste at that location. We can max it out at 24. So at the time we tested that well, we think 1,200 or so was coming in the bottom where the screen and liner assembly formerly was. A chunk of it was coming in around 900 to 920, the high fluoride spike, or we thought the high fluoride spike was, and the balance was coming in above. Back when we talked about this construction and how to rebuild this hole, we went through, actually, I think we went through every scenario we could think of to what to deal with this hole, ranging from plug the bottom, I mean, be done with it, plugging the bottom, all of that material, basically from 900, 920 on down, you end up with essentially well 8, which is an 800 to 1,000 gallon minute well, more or less, with low fluoride. The alternative, and it was what we've been trying to do, was to try to target the high fluoride production, knock that down enough that we still maintain high production, maybe 2,000 gallons a minute, something like that, with fluoride at the surface that is at or just below 4, so that when you mix it into the system in total, the system as it operates throughout the city would be okay with that water. So that was what we were trying to do. We weighed all those options. I think I talked to our dean quite a lot. We worked with ecology to figure out how to do within the ecology well rules, what to do, what not to do. And that took us to where we started on the well rebuild work a couple months ago. And the bottom line with that was we originally asked ecology for what is known as a variance to the well construction standard to leave that liner and string assembly in the well. Don't touch it. Because that construction, casing at the top, a bunch of open hole, basically 800 feet of open hole, and then a casing line assembly at the bottom is out of compliance with the current standard. When that well was built, it was in compliance. As long as we never touched this well, that's fine, it would have grandfathered in. The driver to get rid of fluoride from Department of Health dictated we have to rebuild this well. To rebuild this well, that kicks us into coming into compliance with regulations as they now stand. We tried to get a variance. Ecology would not grant the variance to leave that liner in the bottom. Now that's where we're at today, which is, none of us thought it would come out. It is quite frankly not something I would ever tell anybody on a well job. Oh yeah, 200 feet of liner, 1,000 feet down, no problem. That's going to come out lickety split. We all were afraid it would move, and we were afraid it would come halfway up the hole, break up on us, and really mess the well up. Well, we were actually quite there. The contractor was quite successful in removing it, amazingly successful. Came out clean as a whistle, hardly any problems with at least the removal of the liner, and it worked great. Unfortunately, it revealed unanticipated hydrogeology in this well. Turns out that the top of that liner is at 997. The top of that liner was at 997. What we found after that liner was removed and we went into the well with a video system, we found that at 1,002 feet, rubbly flow top material, the type of basaltic material this well is in, the type of basaltic material that can produce groundwater was present. Not only was it present, it had collapsed into the hole and sealed the hole, or didn't seal, that's an improper word, plugged off the hole with rubbly debris at a depth of 1,005 feet. So this well, as of the video 3 weeks ago, is now 1,005 feet deep. It is no longer 12,000 or 1,210 feet deep. With that collapse, though, we observed a condition that didn't surprise me, but it's a condition that, is important for this conversation. We can see in the video the plug, the debris material that collapsed in. I said before I used the term seal, inappropriate term, did not seal the bottom of the well. Basically, it's rocky debris that collapsed into the 17-inch bore and piled up in there, and when that happened, big rocks fall into the hole yay big. There's still going to be ways around that debris. And in the video, we can see evidence of water moving up through that debris pile up into the bore. We knew we had uphole movement before when the liner and screen assembly was in. We could see that. We knew what was there. Ecology knew what was there. We had convinced ecology at the time we looked at all this that, another thing to keep in mind, the Grand Ronde Wanapum contact, a very important feature for something to avoid, which is known as a commingling well. We had convinced ecology that that commingling contact is below the bottom of the deepest screen that was in that hole during when that liner assembly was in there. That liner assembly is now completely gone. We can only get to 1,005 feet with this video. We told them the boundary, the commingling boundary, was at 1,100 feet. They bought off on that. We can see water moving up through the plug. In the video, we cannot document where that water is coming from now because well, it's got big chunks of rock development. So we don't know now, with that liner out, do we have a commingling hole or not? So one thing to keep in mind as we go through the rest of this discussion. One other thing that happened when this whole collapse, we saw the whole collapse in the video, was that's exactly what happened at the contact with the high fluoride when well 8 was being drilled. It threw in the question whether or not the high fluoride hit we had in 2008 with this submersible sampling system we used, was that a real hit? What was that? We thought the real hit at 920 feet corresponded to the big hit in well 8 when well 8 was being built. At 920 feet in this well, that is not a rubbly collapse prone interval. In well 8, the high fluoride hit is associated with a rubbly collapse prone interval. We have now found a rubbly collapse prone interval in this well, 1,002 feet actually. So that called in the question, well, was that high fluoride real? Was that a transient event going through the well? Could happen. Was there a lab mistake? We were unable to run duplicate sampling at the time we did that work in 2008 because basically the sampling system got stuck in the well, which is another conversation, which I'm not going into tonight. but it got stuck in the well, so we did one sample run on the well in 2008, got one hit with a high fluoride content. 2010, 2011 comes along, we now see a condition which is remarkably similar to what happened in well 8. And that called into question, okay, what's going on? Is this the same horizon? And is our target the seal, this interval of 1,000 plus, or is it this interval of 920? When we saw that, we went into the ground a couple weeks ago with the drilling contractor to try to get some additional samples on the well. We basically ran in a small volume sampling system that ran on a small volume pump. Did not run the big line shaft turbine in. To try to get an idea, does this spike that we thought we saw in 2008, is it still there? Can we get a feel for what, you know, were we right before, or is it actually something different? When we ran that sampling, we did it at 872, 903, 953, and 1,002 feet. The high value was 5.96 at 903. The low value was 4.32 at 872. But that was the only value, actually none of the values were below 4, the regulatory standard. We had 5.652, 5.3.2 at the bottom of the hole right now at 1,002 feet. So that water coming up through that plug is 5 plus milligrams per liter nitrate. At 953, which is below what we thought our target was before, we see 5.36, 5.25. At 903, in the zone where we thought we had our target was before, we have 553, 596. And at 872, which is well above that, we had 503, 432, and 579. So we had numbers all over the place. One other consideration in what these fluoride concentrations might mean is at 894, we know water is exiting the borehole. And we know that because we see it on the video. We literally could see we had flagging on the video camera. We were watching particles moving in the hole as the camera is stable. And we could literally watch aerial come up past the camera view, hit a zone, and turn and head off into the rock. We could also see the flagging flapping into the hole where that water is exiting. So pretty convincing evidence water is going that way. It's leaving the well bore. That's just above that 5.96 spike, if you will, that we got on this last round of sampling, literally 7 feet away. So, at this point, with these numbers, we're pretty convinced that, you know, I think the bulk of the problem actually is the bottom of the well in this hole. We think that 15 may have, we're actually not sure what the 15 was from 2008. We're not seeing it now. We're seeing everything coming off the bottom being high. Yeah, 903, 910, 920 might be a problem, but by the time we reach 894 feet just above that, we know water's leaving the hole. That water's not producing in, that water's trying to get out. It will come back in when we turn a pump on, but when we pull in the bad water that's exiting down gradient, we will be pulling in clean water coming in from up gradient. So hopefully that water coming in at that 894 depth would be a mix of the water that's trying to get away going down gradient, but there's also water coming at us from up gradient that we'll be pulling on as well. So all of that kind of leads us to what next? Are there any questions? This is a story. That's an interesting well. So what next? A couple of options, one of which may, there may, in a sense, there may be no options. I should say no options, but some options, all things being equal, if ecology doesn't weigh in, and the memo I wrote, which is what I have here to Larry and the gang of GNO, to Amon. Okay. In the memo I wrote a couple weeks ago or a week ago, whenever it was, I talked about basically two options. One option is go on the pump system right now and pump it to see what it's going to do with that collapsed plug in the bottom and just see what it is. Right now, we've sampled at depth and we know there's a lot of 5+ mg/L fluoride down there. We also know from all the other wells in this region, plus the work we have done before, that above that, the water gets cleaner and cleaner. Relative to fluoride. So one option would simply be run a pump system in, pump it, and pump it and see what we get. I will be reasonably certain production will be significantly decreased. We have lost the bottom of the hole between 10,000 and 5 feet. We're not going to pull 1,200 gallons that used to come through that screen interval down below. We're probably not going to pull 1,200 gallons through a hole that big that's mostly blocked off with rock. This hole has already lost a big chunk of its production, simply because of the collapse. So that would be one option, run a pump system in, test the well, see what the water quality is, see if it's good enough. We've lost the bottom of the hole, so the bulk of the production in this well will now be made up from everything above there. Most of the intervals above there have less than 4 mg fluoride. This hole might be clean enough now to use. And by running a pump system into that, into the well as it is right now, you can find that out. Another option would be to, well, actually with that, you could then see what you've got, decide what to do, decide what the final well performance is going to look like if you do that. I would recommend two things. I would recommend a long-term duration pumping test along the well. The purpose of that long-term pumping test, long-duration pumping test, and by that at least 3 days constant rate, would be to determine what is the pumping performance of this well. Get those numbers solid so you know what the drawdown at whatever that pumping rate, and we don't know what that pumping rate would be now because we've lost the bottom of the well, but you determine that pumping rate. The other reason for pumping 3, if not more days, would be to figure out, take a look at the fluoride concentrations in it right now, because I told you earlier, we have a thief zone, we have high fluoride water exiting the well. When you turn that pump on, you're gonna bring some of that high fluoride water back. And a 4, 5, 6, or 7 day test would help establish, okay, I know I'm pulling bad water back, how much of it is out there, how much of it's gonna affect my well, and can I see, well, actually you're doing, for those of you who have wells and have done well development, we're basically doing well development. We're trying to figure out how much of that bad old fluoride that has exited the well we're bringing back, so we can determine, okay, how long do we need to pump this well, either in the system or not in the system, to get it down to an acceptable level, because we will see a decline curve in the fluoride content with the bottom of the hole cut off and not supplying significant amounts of fluoride to the well. That's one option. That's kind of the Kevin's favorite option because he doesn't have to worry about budget option. And I wasn't tasked with budget by Larry and the gang at GNO. What do you think? Well, here's one thing you can do. Another option would be knowing that the bottom of the well is collapsed, knowing that the bottom of the well is a source of 5+ mg/L nitrate, and I'm willing to bet the Department of Ecology is going to tell us, well, that is now a commingling well because the liner is gone. it may simply be time to put a plug in that wall at 1,990 feet, plug off the bottom of the well and move on, see what you got left and adopt that well into the system at that much diminished pumping capacity and probably much diminished fluoride concentration numbers. I do not recommend going in to remove the pump, although I'm not a driller, but I would not recommend that simply because that well house is not designed for putting a drill rig on top of that well and working that collapsed material out of there, trying to rebuild that lower part of the well to get the collapse out, find the Grand Run one up in contact, and build a seal at depth in the well to stop the commingling. That was our original hope. We're keeping our fingers crossed that the liner would not move, that if it did move, we'd go and find that contact and plug it off. Well, it moved so well that everything collapsed behind it. And why it collapsed but moved so easily is a bit frustrating from a production point of view. But that would be the other option. Basically, assume ecology or wait for ecology to come back and say, yes, you have a commingler, plug it. Plug it, test it, see what it can do, see what the fluoride concentrations are, and move forward with a much diminished production capacity well and a reduced fluoride content well. And so really, my first option, Kevin would love to play with the well option, probably doesn't really do much for you except you get more data and information. If ecology weighs in at the end of the day with as a co-mingler, it's kind of a moot point as a co-mingler by their ruling, and it pretty much has to be sealed off. And the only way to do that right now is to build a plug at 990 and below and cut off that lower zone, because that's the only thing we really can do short of a massive amount of money to get a drill rig on top of that thing and try to drill it out and rebuild it that way. I would not recommend that, because I've seen drill rigs perched on scaffolds above really big well houses. That is not a cheap job. So that's where we are at with what we think this well is doing right now. We think the big target really is at depth. We think it's time to plug it off. We suspect ecology is going to require that anyway. And at the end of the day, this will be a 1,000-gallon-minute well. It may be a 12 or 1,300-gallon-minute well. I don't think it's going to be any bigger than that. So it'll be not unlike well, because we've lost the bottom where a big chunk of that production is coming from in the past, along with a lot of fluoride.
I got a question on,
yes,
when you're testing for fluoride, mm-hmm. Now here you got it at 50-foot intervals, but what's to stop when you're doing it, say, at 1,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
What's to stop it from reading what's above it also, because isn't that all commingling in there?
Normally I would say yes, that is the case. That would be a concern. In this well, because we have such strong uphole flow, I mean, literally, the videos on this well are fascinating from a hydraulics point of view, because you can literally see when that camera's sitting still at, say, 953, things are going by and they're heading uphole. So I just sit there and turn the pump on. It was a 5-gallon-a-minute test pump. The water's going by at 50 to 100 to 200 gallons a minute. Natural conditions in that well. We're sitting there at the 5-gallon-a-minute test pump. We're not sucking anything down. We're just picking up what's zooming by. So on this well, I'm really confident the 1002, the 953, and even the 903 numbers, we're seeing what's coming up from below and going by that intake on that pipe. By the time we get to 872, we are above where water is starting to exit the hole. We could be pulling some water down. That might be where that 503 and 432 came from, or above where the bad water is taken off. And we might be seeing an effect of bringing some water down as we're running, but even at those depths, I don't think we are. But at the deeper stuff, I'm watching how much water goes by, and you think, when we sat down and did the calculations, we know our field of view is about 2 feet by, 17.5 inches in diameter, except during time particle speeds. Okay, things are going by that fast in a 2 or 3 foot field of view. We're moving 200 or 300 gallons a minute right there, doing nothing. So 5-gallon test pump, we're just picking up what's going by. So I'm pretty confident these numbers are telling us what's coming from below.
Did you say the static level has basically remained unchanged since the bottom filled in with the rubbly
debris? The bottom, yes. It is. The static water level is staying right around that 400-foot mark. But that doesn't surprise me. I would not expect the water level to change until it's sealed, because it is a hydraulic connection. We could literally see water moving up through the plug. Mm-hmm. So the water pressure below, plus all the water pressure, is all commingled, and it's still at that static level it basically would always have been at, because we haven't sealed it off from letting water move back and forth. What we've done is it's collapsed in on itself, and we can't move large volumes past the plug anymore. But it's still in the same pressure regime. The holes are still there. The pressure still equalizes. Right now, it's still running that same 400 foot, more plus or minus 10 feet depth of water.
So static would be more a function of pressure rather than volume.
Static is a function of pressure, not volume.
What would you expect that to go down if we plugged it?
If we lose when that bottom is completely sealed, it's a very good question. And yes, it should drop, because we're losing the high pressure water in the bottom. That high pressure water does have an effect of pushing that total composite up. By how much, I don't know. It's going to drop, though. We had to look at what's well eight run for depth of water static. No. I would expect it to be very similar to well 8, because when we plug, if the bottom is plugged from 990 on down, this well is going to be very similar to well 8. So I expect a very similar static level.
This might be more of a question for Larry, but based on our current shaft, how deep was our impeller in the old well? Are we down?
770 or so.
770, 785, somewhere right around in there.
785 feet?
Yeah.
Oh, so if the static level drops 200 feet, we're still got the impeller down in the water.
Yeah. Part of the contract we have with the contractor, Holt Services, who's done a great job so far,
really good.
Is to trim the bowls on the impellers if we need to, mm-hmm. once we've done the test pumping. We also have in the current contract for them to do one complete day of testing, like Kevin was talking about. What he would be interested in from the hydrogeological standpoint is probably another 3 complete days, another 72 hours, which would be above the contracted amount with the contractor. We figure with the prices the contractor's given us, with the crane they have to have out there, the equipment, that's probably another $19,000 to $21,000 for an additional 3 full days of testing. We did also check with the funding agency, Community Development Block Grant, and if this were a regular CDBG grant, then they do have additional funds available for change orders once you've proven the need for it. However, as I mentioned earlier, this is part of the ARRA, or the recovery funds from the feds a few years ago, and they do not have additional funds for change orders. There is a lot of amount that came to the state. We were only one of 6 communities to receive the grants, and they said, sorry, any extra is on you guys. But I'm not really sure if the extra 3 days is worth the bang for the buck. If we didn't have the specter of ecology hanging over our head, that it more than likely is going to require us to plug the hole anyway, then I think, yes, it'd be worth it. Just because we could probably see another 1,000 gallons a minute of production out of the well. But since we're pretty much resigned to the fact ecology is gonna say that's too bad, the potential for commingling is there, so plug it off anyway. I don't know if we're really gonna gain that much more out of additional testing.
Wouldn't the cost of plugging be about the same, because they were supposed to put a donut in anyway, so?
Yeah, that cost is covered in the contract, whether it's a plug in the bottom that's 10, 20 feet thick, or around the outside of the donut you're talking about. So that's covered. The first day of testing is covered. bringing the test pump in, pulling it back out, that's covered. It's just the extra time involved with the 24 hours, having to have personnel there, the equipment rental, things along those lines.
So is it better for us to get a hold of Ecology and find out what they're going to make us do?
We've had calls and emails into them for the last week. Yes.
It must be on vacation.
The gentleman that is in charge of this is rather difficult to get a hold of. His supervisors are rather difficult to get a hold of. We're going to keep trying just to let him know what's going on, for nothing else. The next step is to talk to the director of the Eastern Region. And the last time we did that, went over this guy's head. I think he's still pouting. But I think that there's basically two options. One is to plug the hole and proceed with the rest of the project the way it was originally funded, which is to do the one full 24-hour test, grab our samples, which is part of the contract anyway, and see where we are, assuming that we'll probably be in the 1,000-gallon-a-minute range with fluorides under 4 milligrams per liter, which meets all the requirements of the Department of Health.
And the testing I described on multiple days, that's really, that's the cushion if the water starts out at 4.7, 4.8, and we want to see if it's going to drop. If we were to pull a 4 milligram or less sample 6 hours into the test, okay,
sure,
we're done. We know that. I would just then run the test out 24 hours to get an idea what the production performance for them would look like, but then you already have that spec to do. So
when you say plug it and test it, is the order plug it, drop the pump back in the shaft, then okay, so
yes,
we're, and test water coming out then?
The other option is exactly what you're referring to, Mark, where we test it before we plug it, pull the pump out, then plug it, put the pump back in, test again for the same duration or at least facsimile, and then continue with completion of the job. And that difference is probably around 19,000 to 21,000. And we'll probably have to plug it anyway.
That's what I was thinking, you know, we're into it for this same amount, you know, and that don't make
yes.
sense to me when we'll probably have to plug it anyway. You said you still got upflow even through the debris.
Yep.
And that could be our worst water actually coming up through it.
We know it's 5.6, 5.7, 5.8. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, and it really don't make sense just slapping the pump in now and run a test on it, and you come out with the same outcome that you're going to have to put the plug in there to stop that bad water to come up from the bottom anyway.
From an engineering hydrogeological standpoint, it would be interesting to see what the well would produce
yeah.
without the rubble, to see if we're getting that extra 1,000 to 1,500 gallons a minute, and fluoride's around 15 milligrams per liter. But from a practical standpoint, I don't think we can afford it.
The only reason to go down that more elaborate road is static level is driven by the pressure in the hole. The fluoride content is actually driven by the volume numbers. Where is what coming from where? And if, again, Kevin's ideal hydrogeologic world, that debris pile in the bottom has cut off 1,000-plus gallons a minute of 5-plus milligram per liter fluoride. It's possible that with the debris plug in the bottom now, this well might produce water at or just above, at or just below 4, because now the bulk of the production is coming from up high, the better water, and the high fluoride water down below is producing at low volume. Still high fluoride, but low enough volume, but the shallower well dilutes the total performance of the well down to the 4 milligram target. So that's, you know, my ideal world. The practical reality of Department of Ecology letting this construction now stand as is pretty slim. I'll be amazed if they don't rule this as a co-mingler, because we took that thing out, which is what we told them prevented co-mingling. It's gone now. We didn't think it would move.
Plus, with the speed that Ecology has been getting back to us at our requests, it might be sometime this fall
yeah.
before
yes.
they answer us. And we need to have grant funds spent by that.
I got a question on the,
yes,
the size of the pump right now. It's capable of, you know,
yes,
3,000 gallons. Are we going to have to put a different pump now?
Part of the contracted project is to check that out and to trim the impellers. Pumps can have a wide range of their pumping range depending upon the impellers and how they're set up. And if we trim them, chances are we'll be able to use the existing well. But that's something that won't be known until we do the actual test pumping.
What I know about that well, I think that well is a very high horsepower, 900?
600.
In the ranch, yeah. And our other wells are only 450.
Find a gear here, the big well, and do it the deal.
If we're looking at pulling our 1,000 gallons a minute, I don't see the back of the motor. Because we're still, it's going to cost us that high amount to run that big motor.
Absolutely right.
I don't think we need to be running it for 1,000 gallons a minute.
So I think what you're leading to again is we may have another cost still ahead of us that we don't know yet. We won't know until we do the actual test pump.
If can you change the motor without pulling the shaft out?
Yes.
You just put a smaller motor on and have it turn slower in theory?
Yeah,
you guys talk about putting the pump in and out like it's an hour project. I mean, I've watched them. That's quite a project to take that 700 feet of shaft out and disconnect it. And
it takes about a week.
Yeah.
Of constant.
And it's not cheap either.
No.
I think we've been wrestling with well six for years, many years. And I think one reason why we've been wrestling for so long is because we want to get it done right.
Yeah.
We want to do it right the first time. And of course, we've run across these little steps along the way, little problems. And I just want to make sure we get it right the first time. And not have to pull it all again and find out our fluoride levels are still high. At this point, if we lose a little bit of gallonage, I'm ready to make that sacrifice.
I'd say you're going to lose a lot.
Quite a bit.
It'll lose at least 1,000.
We've lost that already with the cave-in on the
bottom. Yes, the cave-in has taken care of that for you. Now you're just basically dealing with what's left.
But that's something we knew going into it, that in order to get the lower fluorides, we would have to sacrifice the high production. It's just where that balancing point was, nobody knew.
So is there a way to build ecology for making us pull out that screen after you told them it's going to cause co-mingling?
go ahead and bill them.
Jeez.
Jeez.
I'm kind of leaning with, I think, what Ken is indicating. Plug it, drop the pump in, and see what happens.
Well, it's pretty much a moot point because we've been dealing with ecology on this for years, and they have constantly come back with it's a commingling well, and if it's a commingling well, it's got to be plugged off. So they're going to come back and say that anyway.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make any sense to spend an extra $20,000 that could go to a possible
right.
future pump if that's what they're going to come back and say anyway. And they will.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure you're right.
That being said, I know that Public Works will indicate that they'd like to see well 9 move forward as quickly as possible. We don't have concern with summer, but
yeah, but well 6 has hardly been running. I think I'm on record as saying if I get 1,000 to 1,500 a minute out of well 6, it's a good water, that's better than the situation we are now.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's you know, that much a minute is a lot of water.
To basically proceed with the contract the way it stands now, but whichever you prefer, we'd be happy to accommodate.
There's no additional expenditure funds if you're going to just use the grant funds and plug the bottom. So just a direction from the mayor to the engineer would suffice. And there's no, if you're going to go with just plugging the bottom, go with it. It's within the grant funding that you already approved.
Is that what everybody's leaning towards?
So just so we're clear, plug the bottom, drop the pump in, pump, see where we're at.
See what you got.
It'll be a 24-hour duration
mm-hmm.
plus an 8-hour step test just to to put as much stress on the system as we can.
Will they video again after they plugged?
I would recommend they should. Yes. Okay. It's always a good idea to do that and do any type of rebuild, make sure everything's where it's supposed to be.
Are we good just plugging to where the top of the rubble is now?
Bottom, so the top of rubble is 10,002. The bottom of the next production intervals is 925, 930. I'd go for a 970. If I was going to recommend it to these guys in the filler, I'd recommend a 970, 980 top of plug. That gives you lots of rat hole below the existing production zone for junk to fall into, and that's always good. So I'd do a 970 or 980. And
it won't just be a solid 20-foot plug because of the rubble on the bottom. The grout's going to sink down into there to cement it off. So in some areas it'll be 20 feet, some it might be 25. And it'll probably be ragged on the bottom.
It'll be a gravel bentonite cement plug stack. Put gravel in, put bentonite in, put a cement plug, cement grout plug on top, hard bottom, that we should do.
So will that pretty substantial upflow cause problems for them? Trying to plug it?
I've seen wells where it does.
Okay.
Actually seen wells where it blows the plug completely loose before it sets. With the loss in volume coming up from below, I'm hoping even though it's still high pressure, Larry needs to talk with the driller. They need to make sure they've got their pressures figured out and their weights figured out. That might drive a thicker plug. I don't know. But, they may shoot for more weight or use a heavier grout. The pressure gradient would be of some concern. I've seen them come out. I've seen them go downhole and get sucked out the bottom. And I've seen them get blown out uphole. So if the pressures, if the cement weights aren't done right,
I'll get in there and stomp.
Yeah, they need to. These guys. I do geology, man.
We'll work with the contractor on that.
Okay.
So there's no way to push ecology to get here before we do this? No way, huh?
Kevin, do you agree with Guama that water down there is 10,000 years old?
Or older, yes. It's well, since we're doing the work, yes, I do.
I'll tell you.
Actually, that Othello Well 8's got some of the oldest water in this part of the basin. Amazed the hell out of me. Pardon me.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kevin.
You're welcome.
Larry, thank you for coming. Okay. 4.4, ordinance amending OMC Chapter 17.70, entitled Accessory Uses, Buildings, or Structures. Daryl?
Thank you, Mayor. Council, good evening. Before you for consideration again is the Planning Commission recommendation regarding accessory structures. And at the last council meeting, you may recall, at least two options were discussed that would modify the Planning Commission's recommendation. Those specifically were modifying the limitation on size. The Planning Commission has suggested that the size be limited to the overall square footage of the house. And there was some discussion at the last meeting that the size would be limited to that or a particular size of square feet. 1,200 square feet was one that was thrown around. And so it would be either or, whichever is less. So if you have a 1,500 square foot house, the limitation of the garage would be 1,200 feet under that scenario. The other option that was discussed at the council level was to not limit the height of the accessory structure to the residence, but rather place a cap on the overall height of the structure. And one of the discussion points of that was to ensure that a accessory structure garage would be able to accommodate an RV or a motorhome. And in looking at that and looking at the pitch requirements of the roof, it appears as though a 20-foot structure would be able to accommodate the motorhomes that are on the market today, accounting for a 14-foot door. It should be sufficient height with air conditioners and luggage things and all sorts of things that you put on top of a motorhome. So the 20-foot height is one that if you set as a maximum height, it would be larger than some of the residences and neighborhoods but it would be able to accommodate the RVs as was discussed at the meeting. So those are the options that we heard as staff. If there are others, we can certainly include those in the discussion. So you have the Planning Commission recommendation before you, and then you also have these other options that were discussed at the last council meeting for consideration. Be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Now, what was the height of an average house?
They generally run in the 14 to 15 foot range.
So go to 20 feet, we're talking 5 feet.
Additional 5 feet. I actually went home and tried to compare it to my house, which is a single family kind of rambler style. It runs at just over 15 feet. And in order to accommodate my travel trailer, I would need to build it at 19 feet.
Now you're talking the top of the pitch of the roof. Is that what we're talking about, or are we talking the walls?
No, the walls would be 14, and then that would allow accommodate a pitch of the roof that would take it to 20.
Okay.
And actually, you could go 16-foot walls and have a 14-foot door if you were to take that scenario. Yeah.
I guess my opinion is that 5 extra feet isn't that much, so especially for people with motorhomes, that if they really want to store them inside, that'd be a nice option for them.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but during the discussion last time, didn't we talk about the limitation being a percentage on the footprint?
Well, there's of the lot. Limitation in the code that puts a cap on the total area that can be covered by structures on a lot. Okay. So if you own one lot or a series of lots, maybe 3 lots, the way that ordinance is currently presented to you, no more than 45% of that lot can be covered in structures. And that's where the percentage factor comes into play.
Comments from council? Anybody in the audience have a comment you want to speak to the council? No?
I'm not seeing the original document that had all the information.
That was out.
Because there's actually a motion that was tabled that was based on that.
Is that what he's talking about?
No, that's... No? That's something from Ken Taylor.
If we didn't carry that over.
Okay.
Oh, we can look back, right? Yeah, you could.
I could what?
You could look back.
You can look back.
The last agenda, the last meeting.
I'm just the proper procedure. I thought we'd have to, it was made and seconded, we'd have to eventually vote on it, unless we vote to table it again.
And actually, my recollection is, Councilman Spohr, that the matter wasn't tabled, it was continued. So, my mistake.
Does that mean it has to be voted on eventually?
It has to be taken off the table if you wish to take action.
Is that a motion?
Yes.
What if that doesn't, nobody votes to take it off the table?
It stayed there. Come back up next meeting.
Well, I think we're convoluted now. We've got motions going and based on something we don't have, and we got recommendations, and I don't know that we've gained anything.
You can go back to January 10th. Just go to January 10th, and under accessory structures, it's right there.
Yeah, but I made some specific changes to it on the motion.
Does anybody have the motion that we can read it? From 2 weeks ago?
The minutes that you approved includes your motion to table.
Again, our I believe you had made two motions that were not seconded. And so the motions died for lack of a second. They were actually motions that were being considered.
No, the second one, I believe, was seconded.
Yes.
So this shows the ordinance as it was presented at the last meeting.
Okay, go ahead and scroll down a little further, would you please?
How are we marking it?
Stop. It was the, I know one of them was, they were worried about the percent, and I think I changed percent to 40%, but it seems like there was another one.
The height.
Yeah.
It was the height, the 20-foot. Yeah. Well, the intent of the Planning Commission was to limit the height to the size of the existing residential structure. But if you read that, it isn't clear. And so we were suggesting that to meet the intent of the Planning Commission, you would add that language into the ordinance that was presented before you.
And I think that was in my motion, because that was my intent, that the accessory structure not be higher than the primary structure, and it could go to 40%, so it could be a little larger.
Okay, and your motion, Council Member Spohr, was a change to E3.A, the detached accessory structure does not exceed size and height for the primary dwelling unit, and change to 3A, no more than 40% of the lot may be covered by buildings.
Yes.
That's what you're saying.
I think adding 5 feet to the height of the maximum height of the structure is good, so that you can get the RVs in there. It gives people some place to put.
And that one I just read died due to lack of a second, and then Councilor Spohr made a motion to adopt ordinance amending the Delaware Municipal Code with a change to 3.A. The detached accessory structure does not exceed the size and height of the primary dwelling unit. Second by Councilmember Deaver, motion carried. The motion carried to the table.
I'll restate it. I just adamantly disagree with Gina. I think the standard and aesthetic of the neighborhood far exceeds those people with motorhomes, and I don't think a dwelling, accessory dwelling, should all of a sudden stick up out of above everything else to accommodate that.
Driving around town and looking at some of the smaller homes in town, I'm not sure they even have 4 and 12 pitch roofs. They're pretty low, where the and that like maybe 2 feet above or so above the wall structure would be. So you'd be limiting any kind of a building on a lot that has that kind of a house on it to, you know, if you try to make it very big, why, and you require 4 and 12 pitch on the roof, you're going to have an 8x12 building. Is about what it's going to amount to.
And the ordinance allows for 3x12, so that would give you some play in that, but it would be difficult on some.
I think there are a lot of houses in town that are pretty low.
And one thing that, if you just have a lot of, I would think a lot of older people might move into a single story house because they don't want to be climbing up and down the stairs. And a lot of times that's the people that have the motorhomes because they're able to just get out and go. And if we limit it to less than 20 feet, only as tall as the house, we're not allowing, they would have to buy a two-story house so they could put in a garage. And so that's
even better, they're gonna have to pay to store their RV someplace, and there's no place in town to do that.
And I'm agreeable on the 5 foot.
I don't think 5 feet is going to make that big a difference to most roof lines in town.
No. it's not going to be that, to me, it's not going to be that noticeable.
No, I mine is above my
house. Especially where the accessory structure has to be.
3 feet? What is it?
I think it was only 2 feet.
Is it 2 feet? Okay.
Yes.
I don't remember what
the
measure
was. Yes.
Square footage. In place.
Yeah.
I mean, if the lot's not big enough to build the structure, it's not going to happen. Kind of a catch-all.
So with this ordinance, they could also build on the front of the house? Or is this only detached?
They would still need to meet setbacks. So an attached garage could be on the front of the house. That's not allowed. This is only regulating detached structures.
Okay, detached only. Okay.
So most of these would be on the back side.
Well, kind of. I mean, the one up there at Olympian 14th is an example where it's not on the back side, and I know there's some lots on up there on 16th, 17th up that way that have like a lot and a half that they could have this structure front and center, just the normal setback.
There is some that already have that structure.
Correct.
I think Dr. Simmons has that structure.
Yes. That's a good point.
And there's one of our newest ones that was just built in the last couple of months up on 10th Street. And it is about a foot and a half higher than the house. But with this ordinance, it wouldn't have been allowed. That currently looks really nice. It looks good with everything else around there. Fits in it. It's not too large. And under the current ordinance or the proposed one that we had before, that would have been allowed just for that foot and a half.
The truth be told, this probably doesn't apply to any of the houses being built in the Olson addition right now, because I don't think there's any way you could build a setback, or if you went to the backyard, you can't get to your backyard because there's no alleys and only a 5 foot fence line.
Because of the size of the lots there, they'd be pushing the maximum lot coverage requirements as well. So
I think the 40% rule is going to come into effect before anything.
My neighborhood's that way. You can't get in your backyards.
Yeah. Could you get a motorhome in your backyard?
If I had an alley, I could.
But as of now, no.
No, I got five feet on either side. Yeah. And that's it.
Hey, man, you want to read us the motion again that was first and seconded? Do you still have it up there?
No, it just went up.
So I guess we have to decide, first of all, we have a motion on the table that we've just brought back to life, correct? We need to vote on it if we want to get rid of the table motion.
If the motion was removed from the table, but seconded and passed, then the motion that was tabled is back before the body.
Mm-hmm. So we need to bring it before the council again, so we can decide if we want to continue with that motion or if we want to look at voting no against it and coming back with another motion. Is that right, Jim?
Yes. You either pass or fail after it's off the table.
Okay.
You read the original motion back, please.
That's what we're trying to get to.
Yes. Or you want this one that carried motion to table, or you want the first one?
No, the one that was
seconded and tabled.
The council members were made a motion to adopt an ordinance amending the Felton Municipal Code to include Chapter 17.7, titled Accessory Uses of Buildings or Structures, with the change to 3.A, the detached accessory structure does not exceed the size and height of the primary dwelling unit. Seconded by Council Member Deaver. Council carried a motion to table this issue. Motion second, proceed, Johnson.
Okay, so do I hear a motion to remove that motion by Mark and Dan off the table? Is that what I need to do? Okay. We don't move it off the table. Where are we at? It just comes up next meeting again.
It stays on the table, and we'll come back next week.
So we need to decide what we're going to do with this motion. Are we going to keep carrying it forward, or are we going to deal with it? So. Do I hear a motion?
Motion.
Okay, Mark Snyder first. Charles seconded. Okay, any discussion now on that motion? You want to read it again?
Gladly. Councilmember Moore made a motion to adopt an ordinance amending Othello Municipal Code to include Chapter 17.7 titled Accessory Use of Buildings or Structures, with a change to 3.A. The detached accessory structure does not exceed the size and height of the primary dwelling unit. Seconded by Councilmember Fever.
And just to be clear, the motion we're voting on now is not, we're not voting on that motion. Correct. We're voting on getting it off the table.
Correct.
Correct. Okay. So all in favor then of getting it off the table, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Oppose, the same? Okay. Now, can we discuss that? Other people?
You have a motion before you that's been seconded, and it is open for discussion.
Yes.
Okay, I guess I think that we should change that to read not to exceed 20 feet and keep the 40% in there.
40%, that's right, you switched it. Yeah. Okay.
May I?
Yes.
I understand Daryl's report. The lot coverage limitation he's talking about is from your zoning code.
Correct.
Which is 45%.
Correct.
The 40% was discussed independently, and it's not part of Mr. Spiller's motion that was seconded. So there's no confusion.
So we're still at 45?
Correct. That's so where it would stand, because Mr. Snyder was talking about changing the height to the 20 feet and commenting on the coverage, the 40% coverage. I want everyone to understand it's 45% coverage and it's not contained here, it's contained elsewhere in the coverage. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Okay, do we feel do we want to vote or discuss more? Okay, Mark. Snyder would like to see the height raised up to 20 feet.
If with the with the consent of the motion, with the maker of the motion, I would remove the second if we want to stop and start all over again, if he would say remove the original motion. Can I do that?
If you wish to withdraw your second, then the motion would have to find if it has another second. If it does not have another second, then it would now die for lack of
So, Dan, are you removing the second? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the maker of the motion. I think I made the motion originally just so we get a vote and get one way or the other. You vote on the motion as it stands, I guess.
Okay, any more discussion on the motion as it stands?
Now, can Mark move to amend that?
Any council member may make a motion to amend the motion if they wish.
But the second and the first have to agree, correct?
No.
No. Okay.
So I'll make the motion to amend the motion to read the detached accessory structure will not exceed 20 feet.
May I help?
Yes.
Because I don't think you have the minutes before. The motion before was the detached accessory structure does not exceed the size and height of the primary dwelling unit. As I understand your motion, it would then read the detached accessory structure does not exceed the size and 20 feet in height.
Correct.
But size of the primary dwelling unit at 20 feet in height. Okay. So that's your motion to amend.
So the 20 feet would take precedence?
Yes.
Okay, so it's a two-story home. The 20 feet would take precedence?
Yes, as the amendment is proposed.
Okay. Bob, do you have something?
Yes. The original motion talks about no more than the size or the height of the primary structure.
Mm-hmm.
The way it's worded right now, if I understand it right, it cannot go up to the height of this primary structure if it's more than 20 feet.
Correct.
So you're saying you can't go higher than, you can't go up to the top of your house if your house is a two-story house.
The proposed amendment is to limit the size to the same as the primary dwelling unit and height to 20 feet. So if your house is 40 feet, you're stuck at 20.
Yeah, but before that amendment, you could have went to 40 feet.
Correct.
So what you want to do is shrink the size of the house. I want to make sure you guys understand. You're lowering the size of the accessory structure for a two-story house. Do you understand that? If you vote yes.
Are we?
That's exactly
good point. So if I have a two-story house, then I'm limited to 20 foot.
It can't exceed 20 feet unless the primary residence exceeds 20 feet.
I don't want it to exceed 20 feet at all.
You don't like Angel's house?
I want it.
You don't like Angel's garage?
Jim, you have a suggestion here?
Well, no, we were just discussing that before this discussion probably goes much further, there should be a second to the amendment.
Okay.
And perhaps before anybody seconds anything, the council might want to think about getting these motions resolved without really making a decision right now, and give some direction to have the ordinance rewritten and brought back to you.
Sounds good to me.
That was our goal, and not sharing the ordinance again was to get council's direction on the options, come back next time with another ordinance with your desires in it. So if you go for a second now and it dies for lack of a second, everything's off the table.
It's not.
Well, no. He's off the table.
Yeah. He's off the table. Or he may withdraw his motion, and he's off the table.
Right.
Mr. Spohr's original motion is still on the table. Until it's resolved or withdrawn.
Okay, I guess I would withdraw my motion.
Okay, in that case, as what we're looking for, then I will withdraw the second to the original motion.
Mr. Spohr is allowed to find out if he can file another.
Yes, correct. Mm-hmm. Okay, Dan Deaver is withdrawing his motion. Is there another second for the original motion produced by Mark? Councilman Spohr. Okay, then the motion fails. All right. Okay. All right, died. Now, how do we want to instruct Daryl to proceed? Do we want a limit of 20 feet? That's the question, I guess. It seems to be coming forward right now.
I think there should be a limit of 20 feet on a single story dwelling. But, if they have a two story house, I think.
No taller than the two story
house. No taller than the two story house.
I think a way to phrase that would be that the height of the limitation is 20 feet or the height of the structure, whichever is greater.
You say the height
40%
at 20 feet or the height of the primary dwelling, whichever is the highest.
Yes.
And then 40%.
It always fits in the scheme of the structure, right? Or should it?
Yeah.
Okay, so we just mentioned 40%
of the lot.
Is that going to change a lot of our ordinances?
Well, it's going to make this particular application inconsistent with the rest of your zoning code, which says 45%.
This
changes the existing code to 45, so that accessory structures can exceed the code as it currently is written.
So, as I understand this, if you have a 1,200 square foot house, the 45% then would be a 30 by 40?
No, it's 45% of the total lot area. So if you have a 10,000 square foot lot, you can cover 4,500 square feet of that with structures. So if you have a 1,500 square foot house, you have some This is why you need to come on that petition. You have 3,000 square feet remaining.
Well, in other words, what the, actually the size of the lot has to do with it rather than the size of the primary structure.
Exactly.
So this is actually increasing the current code. 45% is increasing the current code. So I would say 40% would be more than enough.
And that's existing code, right? Yeah. 35 is existing code. The Planning Commission felt, just to express their views, the Planning Commission felt that if you were limiting other aspects of the accessory structures, it made sense to allow certain types of lot coverage.
But we're also increasing, we're saying,
we're increasing
the height, yes. So I think 40% would be more than enough.
You want that brought forward to you guys by Daryl next week?
Could we come back with
or
that?
Or 2 weeks?
Week?
3 weeks,
with
I guess.
That language put in it so we can read it. And
so just to be clear, I'm hearing that we limit the lot coverage to 40% and that we limit the height of the structures to 20 feet or the height of the structure, the primary dwelling, whichever is greater.
Yes.
Between all lots, so I think we're there.
No, not all nods, but most of them.
Okay.
We'll have that back to you.
Okay.
Whoopee.
Do we want this brought back to us at our workshop in 2 weeks or not? Nope, we're done? Okay, we'll just bring it back.
For a motion.
Yes. Okay. All right. Where am I at here? Ordinance granting a franchise to Cascade Natural Gas, Eamon.
The issue before you is a ordinance granting a franchise to Cascade Natural Gas, and I can tell you, having read this about three times, there are no height or size limitations in this ordinance. Eliminating this ordinance basically is a change from a 50-year franchise agreement to a 10-year. There are some additional insurance requirements that were not previously in the old original 50-year ordinance. The franchise agreement basically allows Cascade Natural Gas to work within our right-of-way. It is a non-exclusive right, which means other people can come in and do the same thing in our right-of-way. And it does contribute a maximum of 6% to our utility tax fund. So with that, I would ask that the council consider a motion to approve the ordinance granting a franchise to Cascade Natural Gas.
Questions? Okay, do I hear a motion to approve the Cascade Natural Gas franchise ordinance? Gina first.
Second.
Okay, Ken second. Ken Johnson? Any further comments or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same? Okay, that passes. Thank you, Eamon.
Thank you.
Unfinished business.
What?
Oh. What?
6A.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. 4.6. Approval of accounts payable checks for 2011.
I brought this out separate, and I want to eventually get to a motion to pay the warrants, except remove voucher number 39332. This is a voucher to the Unemployment Security Division of Washington State that in the amount of $8,700. And two of those individuals on that are collecting unemployment were employees that actually quit. And it was under some unique circumstances they quit. As I understand, we attended hearings and they were initially denied this unemployment. And due to a quirk in the system, which I've confirmed with the source, they're actually able to go out and get another job, quit that job, and get unemployment from us. So we were given no chance to respond again or give our input on that. We just got a bill from unemployment that these two people who quit their jobs weren't terminated, wasn't lack of qualifications. They themselves voluntarily quit to pay them unemployment. I was advised, I know a person that works with this agency, that we might have good cause to appeal this. And that's what I like to do. $6,000 per quarter for these two individuals comes right out of our tax dollars. We don't pay into a, we're not a pool one where it goes like the state has a bunch of money. This is straight off our bottom line. So it's, you know, it's money that could be spent elsewhere. And our taxpayers who are working are paying this bill. So that's why I think it mandates that we, what's the word I want? Contest it. I did notice on the invoice that it's not actually officially due to February 28th. So that gives us a few weeks to contest it without getting penalties or fines in that. So, you know, it adds up. It's $24,000 a year. The person, my source, says, you know, these can go on for 2, 3, 4 years. So I'd like to nip it in the bud now and at least be able to tell our taxpayers that, you know, we did everything we could to try to stop this. So based on that, I move that we pay all, what were the warrants for 2011, excluding voucher number 39332. That's my motion.
I would second that.
Mark Snyder seconds. Discussion?
I think on that voucher there was more than just the two individuals. There are some others. And I think those need to continue. It was just the two. So
you're absolutely right. There are two others. But as Mark pointed out, the whole invoice is February 28th. Yeah.
So will that give us enough time to get the appeal in before?
Yes.
So we can find out an adjusted amount if we need to pay it.
We may not have a hearing, but we'll have the appeal in.
Jim, you got some thoughts? You been involved in this before or not?
Yes.
Okay.
And it worked just like Mr. Spohr said, except we had this happen to us at our office. And we fought very hard to establish we partnered a company with an employee for cause. And they promptly got a job. She only lasted 8 weeks. And then, once that happens, you become part of their benefit calculation 24-month cycle. And yeah, we paid the lion's share of the unemployment. But we investigated challenging that, and I'm very interested to find out what else there is that we missed that allows you to go ahead and challenge the benefit year determination. Because all of those rules are created through a series of statutes from the legislature, and they are in somewhat of a state of flux, because the legislature seems to tinker with them almost every year. And but no, we will be glad to look into it for you again, if that's what you want us to do. But I would say our experience was that we ended up paying.
Okay, my question is, this first they were denied.
They did not collect
unemployment
based on separation of service with the city.
Correct, or whatever, okay.
But it's a tough battle. I mean, it's a real tough battle. But I mean, I agree with you before the track. It really is. Someone's closed apartments.
The only difference here, according to my source, is the circumstances of why they quit.
But remember, they applied after the fact. And that's the first thing they're going to say. Well, they didn't claim on the city of Othello. They're claiming on Joe Schiller.
And that was what killed us.
Yeah, they did exactly. I mean, it's worth a shot.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Okay.
Okay. All right, we had a first and a second. Any more discussion? Okay, so do I hear a motion to pay all of Poodle accounts payable checks for 2011 except 39332? And what else do we need on this, Jim? Anything?
I can, no, that's the proper motion to pay
the person paying. Oh, wait, we have a first and a second. Though.
Yeah, I made that motion.
All right, we already have it. Okay. All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same. Okay, I guess we'll go forward and see what happens.
Thank we will understand the direction from the council to explore it here.
Yes. Unfinished business. Any unfinished business? Okay, new business. Happy birthday to Chief Dennegan. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Any other new business? Mark? Oh. New business. Do we usually have the public involved in new business? Can you do that?
It's up to council.
You want?
Time for public participation.
Is that fine? Okay. Sean, you want to come up to the podium then? State your name and address for the record.
My name is Sean Bates. I live at 1156 East Juniper Street here in Othello. What I want to bring to council tonight is, it could be under old business, it's probably under the bridge, but the City of Othello policy and procedure for the hotel motel tax fund allocation policy. And what I want to remind council of is that Fund 114, the tourism funds that come from hotel and motel taxes here in town, that pay for all of the activities that are that pays for advertising for the fair, the Samuel Crane Festival, the Fiesta, 4th of July, all the funding games we have here in town. There's the City of Othello policy and procedure says that requests will be limited to no more than 30% of annual available funds, or a percentage based on the availability of new funding equitably distributed over the number of applications, whichever is less. So the Crane Festival was approved this year, $9,069. Council approved an additional $5,000 above that. My math tells me that that's $1,200 over the 30% mark, and I wanted to bring that to your attention. So it's very, very generous. When I've been looking through the Othello Municipal Code in relation to the special excise tax on lodging, it leads to lodging tax tourism promotion section in the Revised Code of Washington, RCW 67.28.1816. Number one, lodging tax revenues under this chapter may be used directly by local jurisdictions or indirectly through a convention and visitors bureau or destination marketing organization for the marketing and operation of special events and festivals, and to support the operations and capital expenditures of tourism-related facilities owned by nonprofit organizations described under Section 501c3 and Section 501c6 of the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 as amended. And so a question I want to ask in public is, does this mean that the city administrator and secretary may be paid from the Tourism Fund 114? Is that how all those hours are being paid for? Second, on point number two on RCW 67.28.1816, says local jurisdictions that use the lodging tax revenues under this section must submit an annual economic impact report to the Department of Community, Trade, and Economic Development for expenditures made beginning January 1st, 2008. These reports must include the expenditures by the local jurisdiction for tourism promotion purposes and what is used by a nonprofit organization exempt from taxation under 26 USC Section 501c3 or 501c6. This economic impact report, at a minimum, must include the total revenue received, that's tax dollars, under this chapter for each year, the list of festivals, special events, or nonprofit 501c3 or 501c6 organizations that receive funds under this chapter, the list of festivals, special events, or tourism facilities sponsored or owned by the local jurisdiction that received funds under this chapter, the amount of revenue expended on each festival, special event, or tourism-related facility owned or sponsored by a nonprofit 501c3 or 501c6 organization or local jurisdiction, the estimated number of tourists, persons traveling over 50 miles to the destination, persons remaining at the destination overnight, and lodging stays generated per festival, special event, or tourism-related facility owned or sponsored by a nonprofit 501c3 or 501c6 organization or local jurisdiction, and any other measurements the local government finds that demonstrate the impact of the increased tourism attributable to the festival, special event, or tourism-related facility owned or sponsored by a nonprofit organization or local jurisdiction. So at the beginning of section two, it says tourism tracking is supposed to have started January 1st of 2008. The Crane Festival, the fair, the 4th of July, the Fiesta, all these entities would love to have those solid number figures to be able to say, okay, we get this much tourism money devoted for advertising. Here's the bang for your buck. And a couple of articles, let's see here, Tri-City Herald, December 30th, a couple of others I found on the computer. City administrator is quoted as saying that, let's see here, $40,000 in bus tours, so I'm confident that there must be some numbers to back up all these claims. What I want to know is where the figures of $1.8 million for the Crane Festival are, and if possible, where are the figures for other events that we have here in our area? I think that's good information for the public to have, and I'd like it to be open to the public. Thank you.
Amen. You got something? On the figures came from Roger.
Mr. Bates has had several discussions with Mr. Krug and has been provided, as far as I know from Mr. Krug, been provided the information on where those numbers came from.
Actually, the information provided by Mr. Krug is off of the pamphlet for the 2010 Crane Festival. I want to see charts, graphs, where that money comes from. Show me the money. Show me the money, please, Mr. Krug. He's not here, but this is going to be read in the papers. I want to know where that money comes from. I want to know. Everybody deserves to know where that money comes from. Where did that figure come from? It's his obligation as a county employee to make these reports. Since the 1st of January 2008, they should be on file. They should be readily available for public inspection. It should be available to the public, and I want to know where those numbers come from. I'm not saying that they're wrong. I want to see them because it's peculiar to me in my discussions with Mr. Krug that only the Crane Festival is something that he can track on his radar, and he's not able to track the 4th of July, the Fiesta, the car show, the fair. There's a dozen different groups that get this tourism money. And I think everybody deserves to know where they are on the radar screen. Thank you.
It sounds like to me you need to go to the commissioner meeting. He's county, he's not city, as far as what we're understanding from Roger anyway. Can't speak for everything he said, so. But it sounds like on that issue, and the other issue, you said so many things here. You guys want to answer some of the questions he had, or?
Well, our policy and procedure said we won't debate or answer at a meeting that a question is posed. We will look into it and respond as needed.
Okay. Sounds fair with me then, okay. So I guess you'll get a response, Sean. So, any other new business? Nope, okay. Mayor announcements, I'm going to do that before the executive session. We're going to have union negotiation mediation hearing this Thursday, January 27th at 9 a.m. So Councilmember Doro, Kaler, and Deaver, you're on the committee. And the second one is we have received about 15 dog survey responses. The last day to respond is February 10th. They will be included in the utility bills that go out next Monday, so I'll give them an opportunity again. And the Adams County Volunteer Firefighters Annual Banquet is this Saturday, January 29th, at the Othello Senior Center. Okay, not at the Eagles, it's at the Othello Senior Center this year. Social hour is 6 to 7 p.m. The dinner's at 7, and a presentation shortly after that. Any other announcements? Okay, council will enter an executive session for 20 minutes, starting at 8:40, to decide potential litigation. Our city attorney is present. Okay, thank you. And afterwards, we'll come back and finish the meeting. For 20 minutes, I said.